Okay. This is Ken Samuelson. My address is 545 Southwood Drive, Eden, North Carolina, 27288. And today's date is April 29th, 1998. And I'm interviewing Mr. Robert A. Harden, Jr. And Bob, if you would give your name, date, and place of birth, where reared, so forth, current address and telephone number.
This is Robert Allen Harden, Jr., 319 Taft Street, Eden, North Carolina, 27288. I was born in Burke County, Georgia, September 2nd, 1922. We moved to Birmingham, Alabama when I was 2 years old, and I was raised in Birmingham until the second year of high school when we moved to Greenville, South Carolina, where I finished high school. I went to Georgia Tech in Atlanta, Georgia, in my college, on the cooperative plan, where we would go to school 3 months, work 3 months, alternating. On December 7th, 1942, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
41, yeah.
41, I'm sorry. I was just finishing my third quarter of schooling in Atlanta, and I went down and joined the Army Air Corps.
Bob, can you tell me why you chose the Air Corps?
It was the glamour service at that time.
You wanted to fly, huh?
Right.
And so you enlisted in the Air Corps, is that the idea?
Right.
Was it, since it was a popular branch of service, was it difficult to enlist in the Air Corps in any sense, or did they have any restrictions on the number of people they would let in the Air Corps and this kind of thing, or were they looking for everybody?
No, I recall there was no restrictions or anything.
Okay. So you could join if you wanted to join the Air Force,
yeah.
Air Corps. Okay, so you joined. What happened then? Where did you go at that point, and when?
Well, of course, it was a while before they took me in. Even though I joined in December of 41, it was went up in January before we were called, and we left from Atlanta. I had to go back to Atlanta. I lived in Greenville, South Carolina. I went back to Atlanta, and they shipped us by train to San Antonio, Texas, to Kelly Air Force Base, which was the training center and for the Air Force. Mm-hmm. From there, they sent me to, I was classified as a navigator.
Now, Bob, let's just digress a second. Now, did you choose navigation, or did you want to be a pilot, or how did that work?
I wanted to be a pilot originally, was my thing. But anyway, after we got to Kelly Field, they classified. We had to take tests and so on. They classified everybody, you know, whether we pilots, navigators, bombardiers, or what have you. And I was classified as a navigator. My guess is because I had the mathematical
scientific stuff
in college, you know, that kind of thing. In any event, I was classified a navigator, but apparently at that time all the navigation schools were filled. So I was sent to Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Bombardier School. I completed the Bombardier School in October of 1942 and was commissioned.
And so how long were you at Bombardier School then, approximately? A couple?
Six months.
Well, not that long.
Approximately, whatever. I said, I actually went in 42, January of 42, and I was commissioned the 10th of October, 42. But some of that time was pre-flight training. I was pre-flight training at Ellington Field in Houston, Texas, mm-hmm. which is now NASA Field,
mm-hmm.
Before we sent on to Albuquerque. I don't remember exactly when.
So when you did digress a little bit, when you did some of your pre-flight training, what type of aircraft did you fly in? Do you recall?
No, pre-flight, no aircraft involved.
No aircraft involved.
That's strictly ground training, some of the basic Army IBOs, drilling.
Your arms and ammunition,
right,
and everything else.
Like that. The normal basic training.
It's more like a basic
the rest
training.
Of the Army.
It was more like a basic training. You might say. Okay, and then when you left that, where did you go then?
Went from there out to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I finished got my bombardier rating. And my commission as a second lieutenant. That was the 10th of October, 42. At that point, it's when the...
Was it bombardier or navigator?
Bombardier.
Bombardier, okay.
At that point was when we first learned that about the B-29 program, and the B-29 program required all crew members to be dual rated. So they took some of us who had finished as bombardier, they sent us back to navigation school. Because I was originally classified as a navigator, I assume that's probably why I was chosen to go back to navigation school, mm-hmm. Which was in Hondo, Texas. And I went through that, completed that in January of 43.
Now, when you were in navigation school at this point, I guess, right? What would have been your typical routine, if you can just kind of sum up what you did and what a day was like for you when you were going to navigation school?
Well, in both bombardier and navigation, your day was taken up mostly with classes. Ground classes relating to both bombing and navigation, and then we had our flight training also, which I don't recall being. We did fly every day, but
what type of aircraft would you go up in this training? Do you recall the?
I think they were called A-10. They were little twin-engine planes, uh-huh. Both the bombardier training and the navigation training, as I recall, were the same type aircraft, mm-hmm. A-10.
Mm-hmm. And did these aircraft actually have bomb bay doors and the whole bit that you could actually practice dropping bombs and all?
Oh yeah, we had a Norden bomb site, which was in the nose of the plane, and they had a built with a bomb bay with bombs in there that we would drop on the target.
Now, did you use live ammunition when you were going through this training, or did you have sand bombs, or what did
you?
No,
they were live. They were live, not real explosive, but
they did explode, though.
They'd explode, so you could see where they hit, because we had targets down there. We were bombing. They wanted to see how far from the center you missed, or whatever, how close you got. So they were armed. Uh-huh. To some extent.
Now, when you did your navigation, how far would you go from your base and so forth? And were you and what was that like? Did they provide you some coordinates you're supposed to fly to, and then come back?
Yeah, they would lay out a particular course they wanted you to fly, because all we left Hondo, Texas, which is not too far from San Antonio,
uh-huh.
and fly to a certain city like Amarillo, Texas.
Uh-huh.
Then maybe down to Big Spring, then back. From, so I guess those flights were 300 or 400 miles at least.
Now, when you did this, did you, you flew strictly by instruments? I mean, that was your job, right? I mean, you didn't, no visual reference at all?
No, you always used what they call dead reckoning and, you know, visual sightings. If you could, specific training would be in celestial navigation at night, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Shooting the stars and navigating. We use radio
frequency
navigation quite a bit. And of course, dead reckoning, what you do is using wind values that the weather people would provide you with, and headings and all, and hopefully come out.
Hopefully the wind isn't blowing harder or less and so forth, because that would throw you off, I suppose. Okay, now the training that you received, did you feel like when you finished that training that you were pretty well prepared to be a navigator? Or did you feel like, hey, I've got the book learning?
No, I think we were pretty confident in being able to navigate the plane.
Did you have much of a failure rate on people who did not graduate from that navigation school? I mean, was this something pretty tough to get through, I would assume? Did you have many of your
I don't recall. I mean, washed out or whatever. I'm sure there must have been some. But.
Right. Okay, then when you finished your navigation training, then what, I guess you got some orders to go to.
That's when we sort of bummed around a while, because the B-29 organizations had not been finalized.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently the planes were not ready either, since they were just being built.
So you were trained specifically for the B-29?
Right.
Specifically for it.
And I was in the 2nd Air Force, and it was 6 or 8 months there that I was doing some instructing in both bombardiering and navigation at several places in Texas. I was sent to Walla Walla, Washington as a provisional group navigator for about a month.
Uh-huh.
And finally I got my orders to report to Salina, Kansas, to the 468th group.
Now Salina, Kansas, did that have any bearing as to where the B-29s were produced?
Well, to
were
some
they
extent
Kansas?
They had a factory at Wichita, Kansas.
Uh-huh.
But they also produced them in Marietta, Georgia, and in Seattle. There were several places they were manufacturing. Wichita was one.
Uh-huh.
But most of the first B-29 group were in Kansas. There were,
I see.
Well, there were four groups in the 20th mm-hmm. Air Force. And I think they were all in Kansas.
I see. Now, did you, when you were in Kansas, did you ever go to the plant, and did they give you any training at where they produced the B-29s or this kind of thing?
In our training, there were very few B-29s available, so we did all of our flight training, and mostly in B-17s.
Oh.
Although we had, as I recall, one B-24, and we had one or two B-26s and an anti-B-25. The B-26 was used because it had a tricycle landing gear, similar to what the B-29s had. That was most for the pilots to learn to use the tricycle landing gear.
Mm-hmm.
But most of our actual flight training were in B-17s.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our B-29 training was was being ferried to the manufacturers, pick up airplane and fly them to a notification center. They were coming off the line, and they had all these changes to be made, which they didn't want to disrupt the line, so they'd fly them to a modification center, put on the latest changes they had come up with, and then we would maybe go get the plane and bring it to our base as our plane.
So you had a lot of hands-on B-29 training?
Mostly, like I say, most of the training was strictly in this ferrying the planes from the manufacturer to the modification centers. We did have one or two that we used for our actual flight training and bombing training and things like that from the B-29. Because I got all my training in navigation in just the ferrying mission training for me.
Really. Yeah, really. Whatever kind of plane you were flying, it didn't make too much difference, I guess. Huh? Were there a lot of bugs in the B-29 when it was first produced?
Oh, yeah.
Any that affected you from your work?
Well,
particularly?
When we got overseas, it was. I was reading I had to bail out twice.
Oh, okay.
That was bugs that they never could.
They never,
never did really.
Debugged,
huh? It worked out completely.
That's interesting. Okay, well, let's get some general information now, Bob. When you were stateside, what kind of uniforms did you wear when you were stateside?
Well, normally we'd wear the conventional Army uniforms.
Class A uniform, the dress.
Right. Before I was commissioned, it was, khakis most of the time. It was hot weather out there most of the time, so it was khakis. After I was commissioned, because I wore officer's uniform, everywhere, except when you're flying, you wear coveralls.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, coveralls.
So the dress code was such that you were pretty much, if you were not flying, you were wearing your Class A uniform.
Right. Awesome.
Were you able to dress in civilian clothes any?
Oh, no.
You were not allowed
not
to dress
in wartime.
No civilian clothes. No. Okay, that's interesting. I didn't realize that you had that restriction. When you were taking your basic and maybe digress even when you were after your commission, what did you think of the food that was prepared for you in your earlier period before your commission and then after your commission? Were you pretty pleased with what was available to you?
I think so, because I don't remember anything. I don't ever remember being hungry or not liking anything or whatever. I even like Spam. I just don't remember any problems with the food. Because after being commissioned, everything was in the officer's mess, which I presume might have been a little higher class than enlisted. Mess, but before I was commissioned, I don't recall
ever being unhappy about food supply. Huh? Were you ever involved, again, carrying to later days too, were you ever involved in having to eat K rations and C rations and all the rest of that type thing?
Only when I bailed out.
Only when you bailed out. And you had those, I guess, in your provisions in your.
But I got a couple of packets of sea ration.
That's the only time that you ever ate anything other than prepared food of some kind. Okay. What did you think of the officer corps that was training you when you were going through Bombardier School and Navigator School? Pretty professional group. Did you have any 8 balls in there, or were they all pretty straight shooters and so forth? Anything about that?
I don't remember any unusual situations there.
Uh-huh. Okay. And no, Were you involved with a lot of folks who were like you in the sense that they were in your training in bombardier and navigational training that were volunteers, most of them, or did you have any of your folks that were graduates of the military academies and so forth? Was it a...
Well, I think most of them were volunteers. Most of the volunteers are either, might have been drafted, you know, and then able to be, to get into the Air Force or choose the Air Force or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Did you have many officers? I guess the higher ranking officers probably went through the service academies, I would assume. Is that fair to say? The higher officials in your organization?
Well, I doubt it, you know, because my guess is a lot of them are reserve officers.
Uh-huh.
You know, to have, get as many as they need, I doubt it if the academies could produce that many officers, you know, the way they were building up. So I'm sure most of them are probably reserve officers,
uh-huh.
you know, ROTC, colleges, and things like that.
Okay. Carrying on a little bit then, from your training days in the States and after you, after your time in Kansas, where did you go then? What happened?
Well, when we finished our training in Kansas, we were sent overseas. Each B-29 plane had two crews assigned. One crew flew the plane over, the other crew went by ship to India. We went to Gorakhpur, India, which is out of Calcutta. And I left March 1944. Went by ship. We went to Camp Patrick Henry, Virginia, where we took a ship to Casablanca. In Casablanca, they then ferried us by Air Transport Command to Gorakhpur. So it took, I don't know how long it. Let's see, April, March. Took about a month to get there. We left on the 10th of March and got there on the 4th of April, 44.
Okay, you went to India. Now what was your mission in India? You had the B-29s in India stationed at this Kragpur, I guess. Your mission was to bomb Japan from India? Is that the idea? Or were you doing something else?
Mission was to bomb Japan, but B-29s in long range plane could not fly from India to Japan. So what they had was a forward base in China, and each of the four groups had a separate, were located a separate field. Same way in China, they had four fields up there, separate one, separated. Uh-huh. So we would. Although we were based in India, we'd fly to China, and from there we would fly to Japan.
You refuel, I assume, in China then? Is that the idea?
Right. They would fly in China, and most of that we had to fly over. See, we had to fly the gasoline, the bombs, all the provisions had to be flown into China before we could make a mission to Japan. And it took several flights across the hump. We were going across the Himalayas from India to China. It would take four or five flights of a B-29 to China, carrying ferry and stuff over there, before they could make one mission to Japan.
I see.
And then go back to China and then back to India.
I see. So that forward base in China now, was that forward base in China pretty secure, or was that in an area that was
it was fairly secure. They occasionally would have a Japanese bomb, maybe one come all the way, it was just nuisance money, you know, and there wasn't any real attacks on forward base.
That's surprising me. I guess the Japanese obviously knew about it. They sent at least one plane, a few planes over there. But they never attacked it. I'm surprised they didn't try and demolish that forward base. Okay, flying over the Humvee, how many hours did it take to fly to that forward base in China? Were you in the air? Have any recollect?
It was probably about a 6-hour flight over, and then 6 hours back.
Yeah. Did you have any trouble getting over the hump on that plane with all that provisions and everything you were taking?
Not in the 29. See, the B-29, compared with all the other bombers, B-70, B-24s, was pressurized. And it was designed for high altitude flying. So we had no problem getting to the altitude to get over the Himalayas, even though we'd fly by Mount Everest and we'd be below the top of Mount Everest, you know, that's 25,000 feet, but we'd fly lower than that. Although the 29 could fly that high. The flight plan was such that we'd fly almost due north or sort of northeast, then fly east, then turn back northeast again to our base in China.
Was there a particular reason for that pattern? There must have been.
Well, my guess is it was essentially that was a sort of a flight plan, because the ATC boys were flying the C-47, C-46 cargo plane, they were flying that because they couldn't fly with 15,000 feet or something like that. So they were flying down in the, in the valleys, in the mountains, and as far as I remember, it was better to fly that way than trying to make a straight,
straight shot at it. For whatever reason,
I don't know, maybe we'd have gone right by Mount Everest. So I don't
Okay, so you were in India then, Bob, for approximately how long would you say?
April 44 to May of 45.
Oh, you were in India that long? To May of 45. Is that right? And how many bombing runs did you make from India to your forward base in China and then on to Japan?
I never did. Never did make it to Japan at all.
From India?
Right. What I did, the very as soon as we got there, the first flight over the hump to be flown by our squadron, the navigator of another crew got sick. I happen to know the pilot. So he asked me to take his place as his navigator. That was the reason I was on the plane. And on that very first flight, we bailed out on the India side of the hump.
Oh, the very first flight.
Aye.
Oh, my. At what altitude were you when you were bailing out?
I remember about 20,000 feet. I read some accounts lately that so we were about 15,000, but anyway, we were above clouds.
Yeah, right.
And bailed out. The course, we got back okay after only about 3 or 4 days. We got out of the jungle and got back to our base and so on.
Tell me about that. When you bailed out, where were you when you bailed? You recall approximately?
We were in northern India.
Northern India.
Assam, they call it Assam, near Jorhat, India. As I referred to before, some of the bugs in the B-29s, they had a problem with the engines. And when we started losing oil in an engine, they would try to feather the prop while they still had oil. If they didn't have any oil, all the oil was gone, they couldn't feather the prop, so it just windmilled. And as I said, we were between 15 and 20,000 feet above clouds, and the maps were not that good about how high the mountains were anyway. So, and we had, we got a lot of people on the plane, plus we had an engine in one of the bomb bays. I think we had a gasoline tank in the other bomb bay. And we couldn't get rid of those, couldn't get to salvage them to lessen the weight.
Yeah.
Kept losing altitude. So finally we bailed out. Fortunately, most of us got out okay. One man got killed, but I understand that he landed okay, but he tried to cross the river to get up with some others of the crew and drowned in the river. All the rest of us got out okay.
What did you think, if you can recollect back to those times when you jumped out of that plane? What were your thoughts? Or did you?
Well, you know, you always, because you don't get any training like that.
No.
About bailing out.
Right.
And you read all the story, you know, about counting the 10, pull the ripcord, and all that kind of stuff. All I remember is when I let go, and we, in the front end of the plane, you go down to the nose well, let the nose wheel down, you climb down, nose wheel, and drop. All I remember is dropping and pulling that ripcord right away.
You didn't have time to think about anything else, did you?
Didn't hold it, let it go. And it took quite a while, to get down and get to ground.
Yeah.
I don't remember how long it was, but
sure.
I certainly remember going through several layers of clouds and landing in the jungle. My parachute caught in a tree, so I really didn't hit the ground that hard. It broke the fall.
Were you injured at all when you?
Not really. I had some scratches or something on my leg and whatever. My main concern was wild animals. You know, you land in the jungle and it was dense jungle.
Were any of your crewmates near you anywhere?
Yeah, fortunately, three of us got together. Got together, caught her right away. We started. I believe we started, we knew we wanted to go east, west, no one's going to go west. So anyway, we started, as best we could going west. And it was sort of early in the morning when we bailed out, so we traveled all that day, best we could. Most of the time we were following these animal trails through the
jungle.
Jungle.
Yeah.
And so it got dark, and we hadn't come up on anything, so we slept the best way we could that night in the jungle. And then the next day we did, I believe we saw a plane, and we made it to a river. And there we met some natives. So the second night, they had a hut-like affair that afforded some a place for us to stay that night. And I believe they fed us, gave us something to eat.
Could you communicate at all with them? I mean, they didn't speak.
Not really, they didn't speak English.
But they knew who you were, basically.
Apparently, yeah. And then the next day, they took us across the river on a boat, and some of the rest of the crew that was on the other side of the river. So we all got together, and then we got, I don't know how we got out, not how we walked or what we did. But
you got back.
There was a tea plantation there that some of the other crew, they had gotten there, but we got out. And I guess we all sort of met there, and then they took us to the Jorhat. There was an air base at Jorhat. Because they put us in the hospital for a day or two to check us out, I guess, and then they flew us back to our base.
I see. So that was a total of about two or three days, four days, yeah. Whatever? When you bailed out, Bob, what kind of emergency equipment did you have? Do you recall what they provided with you? You had C rations or K rations, whatever. What else did they give you for that kind of an experience in your little pack?
Yeah, we had the C ration. I don't know how many those had. We had a little mess kit, a dipper for water, and we had yep. some money, we had some foreign money, mm-hmm. we had a flag, we had a flag and thing, we had a machete, of course we had a 45, we had a shoulder holster and a 45 uh-huh. and a shoulder holster. The kit had a poncho in it, of course a first aid kit, mm-hmm. it had some, I guess, chlorine tablets that you could put in the water, the purified water, mm-hmm. sterilized water.
Yeah.
Matches, compass.
Basic stuff.
I guess that's about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Had a flare, I guess. Light.
Right. So that was your first flight, you say?
First flight after we got there.
What an introduction.
Yeah.
So tell me about what you did the rest of the time you were there. You didn't get to Tokyo, so you must have been doing.
Oh, but we
bombing some other bombing runs, I guess.
Well, went back when I got back to the base. The pilot we had come over with us, he'd gotten sick. I don't remember what wrong, but anyway, they sent him home, so we had no pilot. The crew had no pilot.
Yeah.
They assigned the squadron commander's co-pilot to be our pilot. Mm-hmm. And the first mission we made with him was to was the longest mission of the war. We bombed oil refinery in Palembang, Sumatra. Hmm. But to get there, we had to fly down to Ceylon, which is off the lower coast of India, now Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
But we staged there for this flight to Palembang. So we flew down there one day, spent the night, and left the next night late. It was late in the afternoon when we took off. The flight was something like 20 hours, total 20 hours.
Goodness sake.
All over water. We took off and flew at very low altitude, 100 feet or so, because we were loaded so heavily with gasoline and bombs. We flew at low altitude for quite a ways before we even started climbing to conserve gasoline. Worst thing about it was I could do no celestial navigation because of the cloud cover. I couldn't see any stars or anything. So I had to dead reckon the whole way using wind and our speed. Mm-hmm. We did have some wind readings from boats, from ships along the way. Mm-hmm. We used that. Fortunately, we came out right on target. I was about, as I recall, 10 minutes or so early on my estimated time of arrival. When my time ran out, that we were supposed to be there, the radar man picked up the island right ahead of us. So I was lucky in getting there that night. And as I recall, there was not too much opposition on that raid.
And this was an oil refinery, did you say?
Oil refinery, Palembang, Sumatra.
And this was obviously run by, for the Japanese war effort.
Right. It was one of their major suppliers of oil. I've read other accounts where the English bombed this place quite a few times. They always had high casualties, so it was either we surprised them or something. But as I recall, we didn't have that much opposition. There was some.
How much damage do you do? Do you have any? Did you get any readings on what damage you did to this?
I think it was. We had pretty good success in hitting the target. Of course, they rebuild it and that kind of thing. Because, like I say, the British kept bombing it.
Okay, that was you say that was one of the longest missions of the whole war then, huh? The 20-hour flight. Was that 20-hour total, I take, or?
Total.
Yeah,
total.
20 hours total.
Back to Ceylon and from there back to India.
Yeah.
Then, next flight we made with our new pilot was back over the hump in the China. And we were flying what they called a stripped down. It was a stripped down B-29. They took the turrets out. They used a skeleton crew. We only had pilot, co-pilot, flight engineer, radio man, navigator, and only one man, a tail gunner in the back. Mm-hmm. They stripped the turrets out, lessened the weight. Put the gas tanks in the bomb bays. It was what they call a tanker. So we were stricken there in gasoline. We made our trip over to China okay, and then coming back, the same thing happened to us. It happened to us on my first flight. We lost an engine, couldn't feather it. And we were on the China side of the hump this time, so we had to bail out over there.
Is this like your third flight, you say? Was this have been your third flight?
Well,
or approximately?
Yeah. Oh, then probably some training flights. Yeah. There. Let's see, we landed on the China side of the hump. Our tail gunner was injured. He had a broken leg, but as I recall, he had a bad leg and all. Mm-hmm. In any event, we all got together right away. The natives came up to us and indicated they wanted to take us west. Well, that's up near Mongolia. And there's some tribes up there called Lolos, which we had heard, would take people captive and I don't know whether for the Japanese, but anyway, they were not
friendly to you.
Not friendly, right? Yeah. So, but we refused to go with them. That way, we knew that was not the wrong way to go. We went the other way. Left or went the other way.
Did they give you any problem when you said no?
Not really. Again, we had our 45 and things like that.
And they didn't have any weapons other than spears or knives?
I don't recall what they, but they didn't try to force us. We we started walking the other way, east, and a couple of Chinese met us after, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours. And what had happened, when the plane flew over this little town of Fulin, they heard the plane and knew something wrong with it, the way it sounded. So that's when this Chinese, this retired Chinese general started down back down the river towards where we crashed, bailed out. And these Chinese had come ahead of them and met us.
End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
So the Chinese led you back, your group back?
We spent the night in sort of a hut-like affair. I don't know if anybody lived there. And then the next day, we walked on up this river and met with this Chinese general who had come down the river in boats. As I recall, two boats. And then, because we got in the boats and they started going back up the river. And the boats were pulled by coolies. They'd get on one side of the river and pull a while till the bank got too steep. They'd jump in the boats, we'd lose ground and get to the other side. They'd jump out and start pulling up the other side. So it took us, as I recall, all day to, in traveling in the river to get back to this little town of Fulin. Fulin was where this Chinese general lived, and he had a big house in the town, and he had two rooms at the front of the house. It was sort of a house with an open center, and all the house was in the back where they lived, and these two front rooms were empty. So that's where we stayed. They were not beds, they were just hard tables really we slept on.
And how long were you there then, Bob?
I was there 6 weeks. It was back in the mountains of China and during the monsoon season when the rain continued almost. After we'd been there, I would say probably 3 or 4 days, a rescue unit came through, but they only had room for 3 people to take out. So we sent the pilot, the engineer, flight engineer, should go because they always want to know. In the debriefing, you know, what happened to the airplane? Why did it fail? All those kind of things. They were more capable of answering those kind of questions. From my first bailout, I knew that, so that's why I said they ought to go out. And the tail gunner, who had a bad leg, was sent him out because he was injured. Rest of us stayed there, and as I recall, it must have been 4 hours left in there. And we stayed 6 weeks. We were there 6 weeks before they could get back and get us, take us out. Mainly because of the weather, the monsoon condition.
So you were there 6 weeks. And when they finally got, how did you get out? Would they have a plane flying somewhere?
No, they had a rescue unit come through with, I recall they had a Jeep, a weapons carrier, something like that. You got a four-wheel drive.
That must have been very difficult just to get to where you were.
Oh, yeah. And I think they were Army people.
So they got you back to your base in India, then?
They got us back to our base in China.
In China, okay.
Then we were flown back to India. And after we, they sent us to a rest camp. co-pilot had failed to fasten his 45 in his belt. So when he jumped and the parachute opened, the thing flipped up and pulled his arm some way.
Oh boy.
So when they got him to the hospital, they sent him on home. But while we were in there, 4 or 5 hours left, the rest of the crew had flown another tanker over, and they had crashed. They were all killed. Mm. So when we got back, there was no crew except what, us. Yeah. The co-pilot was shipped home, so there was nobody left but myself, the radio operator. There were two or three of the gunners who had not been on either flight. They were still there. So there was essentially no crew when I got back.
Yeah, right.
But they sent us to a rest camp for a couple of weeks. And then I joined another crew, and I can't remember the pilot's name or anything. And I flew several missions. We mined the harbor at Shanghai. We flew to Kunming, which is one of the major bases in South China. Mm-hmm. And we did this with the Navy. We had a Navy man flying with us. And, we had mines that we were flying. Went to China, Shanghai, mined the harbor at Shanghai. Made a flight to Rangoon, Burma from Kragpur. One other place in China. And we went back and mined the harbor again in Shanghai. So those are the 4 or 5 missions that I actually flew on out of India, mm-hmm, before we moved to
Marianas.
Yeah.
Now, just a curiosity, Bob, when you drop mines, how does that work? When you drop mines, I mean, I visualize a plane set up for bombs. How is a plane set up? I mean, I visualize these big round things, yeah, with spikes on them and what have you. How does that work in a B-29?
I really don't recall. It was apparently loaded just like a bomb. And
could you drop them at high altitude, or did you have to
go in low? We had to go in low.
Getting
low altitude, and I guess they were not armed. Was set so they armed themselves after
right
the water thing.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
But as I recall, they were, like you say, around mine.
I have trouble visualizing that, how they did that. That's very interesting. I read about mining harbors by aircraft, but I didn't quite understand how that would work. So then you went to the transfer, of course, the South Pacific campaign. The Marianas was a very key group of islands to capture, because that was within flight range of Japan, was it not? And was Tinian one of those islands, I assume? And that's
right. That's where we were. Saipan, Tinian, and Guam.
All three islands Guam, within bombing range of Japan.
Yeah. Guam. Guam was a U.S. possession. I believe Tinian and Saipan were Japanese.
Uh-huh. I believe so. Okay.
Anyway, Guam was the biggest of the islands, and that's where Admiral Nimitz had his headquarters. But in any event, after they'd taken the Marianas, then they moved all the new B-29 outfits were coming from the States directly to the Marianas.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they were already there when they moved us over there.
What time frame would that be when they moved you to Revlon? Sometime early, early 45, I guess. Huh?
That was May of 45.
May of 45.
Moved up there.
So you moved from India then to the island of Tinian.
Tinian.
And that was a major Air Force base, was it not? That was one of the key, of the three islands anyway, that was one of the key bases.
Well, they had several airfields. They had, I'm not sure how many airfields they had on Tinian. The first, as I recall, they were going to build about four, but I don't know whether they ever built four. I know there were at least two.
Mm-hmm.
Because the atomic bomb plane, you know, Gay flew from Tinian, but it was the other the other airfield from ours.
Uh-huh.
We were at Westfield.
Uh-huh. Now, were they strictly on Tinian, were they strictly bombers, or they have P-51s or P-38s? Or?
They were strictly bombers. I'm sure they must have some fighter squadron for protection, just in case the Japanese ship or something would get close enough to fly over.
So did you make several flights out of Tinian then, I take it, to
Japan? Oh, yeah, I made multiple flights today. I made I made 19 missions out of Tinian.
Mm-hmm.
All to Japan, really.
Mm-hmm. Now, was General LeMay was your commanding general at that point? Was he the one that?
I believe he came over sometime after we went to Marion. I believe he was not the commanding general at that point, but later.
Do you recall who the commanding general might have been? Is that,
you recollect?
No.
When you were bombing Japan, can you tell me what a typical day might have been like on a day that you're going to make a bombing run? I mean, what time did you get up? What time did you get your briefing and all that kind of thing? What time did you eat breakfast?
Well, it'll depend. When we first started, our missions were in daytime,
mm-hmm.
in daylight. So we'd get up real early, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and I guess we'd eat, be briefed, and take off rather early in the morning. So we'd be over the target in daylight.
Mm-hmm.
It was about a 6 or 8 hour flight up there. This was before they took Iwo Jima too, you know, it was still in Japanese hands. And it was really the only checkpoint between the Marianas and Japan was Iwo Jima. It was a night mission when there was firebombing. We would, of course, leave at maybe dusk or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In order to be over the target, maybe, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning
yeah.
the next day.
Now these first missions, as you said, there was a change in philosophy, right? From the high altitude, daylight, explosive type bombing, you might say, you're dropping explosives, versus the low-level incendiary, right? There was a change. What kind of information did you get on that as the reasoning, or did you just follow your orders?
Well, of course, we just followed orders, but you know, as I understand it, the bombing results were not from high altitude daylight. Because of the weather, you'd always run into cloud problems, cloud cover over the target, thing like that. The results were just not satisfactory enough. So that's when they started the, you know, dropping the altitude, even daylight mission, we dropped the altitude, we did our way down to, I don't know, 18,000-19,000 feet. And I recall the night mixing was just saturation bombing. You know, you didn't try to get a certain particular target. You just
trying to burn the whole city.
Right.
That's what you're doing. Right. And what altitude did you come in on that, Bob? Do you recollect?
Was that don't really remember, but
pretty low though, I assume.
Well, you know, my guess is about 15,000 feet or maybe more. You get out into the any aircraft range, you know, you get so low.
Yeah, right.
And they had garage balloons around some of the city lines too, you know, they would be way up in the air.
So these missions lasted, what, about a total of 12 hours then? 6 hours each direction, so to speak? And you were over the target just a few minutes? And when you're over target now, of course, your responsibility was to get the plane there.
Get the plane to the initial point.
And then the bombardier took over, I guess.
To take the heading from the initial point to the target and the... In a sense that the bombardier flies the airplane with the bomb sight.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly drops the bomb, and then because the pilot takes over then and gets out of the plane and we get back.
And what kind of opposition did you have over Tokyo at that time? Was there much?
Well, we'd always have some opposition. Like I say though, on the high altitude missions, anti-aircraft fire would always be bursting below us.
Yeah.
We'd have some fighter opposition. But as I recall, in those 19 flights, I only recall that our plane got hit one time. I could be wrong. But we never have anybody injured on the flight or whatever.
I guess the Japs were running out of resources too at that time.
Yeah.
Planes and oil, gasoline.
Also, and you know, when they took Iwo Jima, then they based fighters there.
Yeah.
And they could fly from Iwo Jima to Japan with us, and they would provide fighter cover for our mission. We were flying in the daylight.
Did you have any fighter cover on your earlier flights before we got your
we were sticking on our own.
On your own, huh? Okay. So continuing on the idea here of a day now, you get up, what time do you normally get up, you say, for say a daylight mission?
Well, about around 4 o'clock.
About 4 o'clock. And you're over the target by
We probably didn't take off till we were about 7 or 8, maybe.
So you're over the target around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, approximately.
Yeah.
And so you get back at 8 o'clock that night.
Yeah.
And then what happened? What did you do? Went through a debriefing, or
went through a debriefing? They wanted all the details there, and then we would.
Was that pretty intense or lengthy, or how much time did you spend on this debriefing process?
Well, my guess is probably about an hour.
Really?
But I don't remember the details.
Yeah, sure.
I know about it.
Right. So debriefing was an hour, and then were you released at that point?
Go back to the barracks, and I guess most of the time, because I would probably go to sleep. You know, the rest of the people on the plane sleep going up, coming back, and everything to do with it, the target, that kind of thing. The radio man would usually wake all the way up. Why didn't he ever fall awake? I was awake all the time. And at least one of the pilots was always awake.
They had missions going every day, I mean, when weather was permissible, I assume, did they not? But how many times a week would you fly? Maybe once or twice, or what?
Is the mission May the 14th, May the 17th, May the 26th? May the 29th. That is four missions in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And on the 1st of June, 5th of June, 7th of June, 15th of June, 18th of June, 22nd of June, 26th. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 missions that month, June
4th. Yeah, so you're about on average anywhere from 2 to maybe even 3 a week then, huh?
Yeah.
So you're a pretty busy group. do you, from your own perspective, did you feel like these, that you were able to accomplish what was expected of you based on what instructions you received so far as the mission that you had assigned to you?
Yeah, I think so. Other than the occasional, when you have to abort, you know, you can't get over the target for some reason.
Uh-huh.
The weather's bad, or you bomb another target, something like that.
Uh-huh.
But in general, I think we were satisfied with the results we were getting.
Able to do just what you were asked to do, huh? For the most part. Okay. Did you have any of your other planes that were in your on this mission with the, any of the missions with you? Did you have many that were shot down, or were for the most part at that time were most of the planes going out and coming back without too much?
Oh, no, we lost quite a few.
Did you?
We lost quite a few. I don't know whether mostly from enemy fire or whatever. Or from just
malfunction,
you know, yeah. The plane, like we always, there's always some problem with the plane. I never get all the bugs worked out completely.
Did the people who flew on the 20th, did you feel a lot of confidence in your aircraft then, or did you have these nagging doubts about, hey, I've got a kind of a...
Well, as a navigator, I never did have any qualms about it, but I'm sure the pilots, co-pilots, those people probably had some.
Yeah. They were facing
about it.
Yeah. Sounds like it was a great plane in theory, but had some problems. Huh? That's people like me, you don't think about that kind of thing too much. You just think about what their mission was and they were successful, but you don't think about the fact, hey, these guys flying this really had a problem with the plane, or could have anyway. Getting back to maybe your time both in India and in the Marianas Islands, what did you feel about the discipline aboard with your squadron that you were in? Did you feel like discipline was well maintained, and people were pretty much dedicated to the fighting effort, or did you find some folks who were kind of wild guys that were in your groups?
The general rule, there was never any lightning or anything like that. Of course, we were, the officers and enlisted men were always separated.
Right.
We had our barracks, the mess hall, the enlisted men had theirs and all, but
no particular.
There was never any discipline problems that I'm involved in, from flight crew.
Were drinking or gambling either one a problem particularly, or I'm sure there are a lot of gambling.
A problem. It was playing poker. Some of them play bridge.
Uh-huh.
There was never enough alcohol. Too much drinking.
Uh-huh. You just didn't have alcohol available.
Right.
To speak of. How about anything like people being AWOL or just deserting, or whatever. You ever have any
problems? The white crew, as far as I know, there was no any problems like that.
Was there any type of discrimination that you were aware of based on race, religion, or anything?
There were no blacks.
No blacks, of course.
Of course, there were plenty of Jewish people, Jewish boys, but what I know, there was no discrimination.
Yeah, nothing like that. Okay, now, so far as your spare time between your missions, you know, you had two, maybe three missions a week. What did you do during your spare time? I don't guess you had a lot of books to read. What did you do?
I really don't know. Like I say, some of the people played bridge and poker games. Apparently, I had something to read. Because there wasn't much else to do, you know. Because we were flying pretty regularly and, you know, Tinian every 3 days or so, 4 days.
Was there any training going on during this time too, or was basically you're already trained and you just flew your missions? Did they have any additional training of any kind that you recollect?
There must have been some, but as I recall, some of the later planes brought over, they had the new navigation system where they had low RAN, long range radio thing. As I recall, some of the newer planes had that on it, and I believe I flew some training missions using that, you know.
To get acclimated.
See how it works and that kind of thing. Although I don't really recall using it on mission.
Mm-hmm. Were there any non-military organizations such as the Red Cross in evidence anywhere?
Red Cross girls were always there after every mission.
Really? On Tinian?
Oh, yeah.
No kidding.
India, too. And they were,
is that right?
I recall when we got back, they give us a shot of whiskey. I don't know what kind it was or anything like that. Man, it seemed like they always got that when we got back, before we got debriefed.
Is that right? Yeah. Anybody else other than Red Cross, or was that the only organization that would be a non-military organization that was there?
I think that was almost there.
How would you characterize the overall health of your squadron, your people that were there on Tinian, and the medical care?
It was always good. Like I say,
good and available. Yes.
Oh yeah.
No problem. Okay. What did you know, Bob, when you were flying your missions and doing, you know, everything that you were doing during your time in the service? What did you know about the overall status of the war situation? I mean, were you informed? Do you feel like you were informed well as to what was going on in your area of combat, or again, were you just kind of flying where they told you to fly and that was it? Just do your missions? Or did you have some feel for the overall war status in your area?
I don't know that we knew that much detail about it. Of course, we got the Army newspaper, you know.
Stars and Stripes.
Would have news accounts of general nature, you know, all over the world, I guess.
And you got that in India as well as on Tinian, huh?
I don't remember listening to radio much, as far as news goes, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Did you ever hear Access Sally?
No, I didn't. I listened to the one from Tokyo.
Tokyo Rose. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I meant Tokyo Rose. Yeah, not Access. Yeah. Tokyo Rose, right. Yeah. You heard Tokyo Rose on the radio. Yeah. And what was your impression of, or do you recollect what your impression might have been of her? Was she actually, I understood that she was actually entertaining. She played music that the troops liked to hear. I don't know what else your impression might be.
Then, you know, she would play things that it was a surprise that she knew, like, uh-huh. you know, a mission we had was going on or just been on or something, you know,
uh-huh.
that kind of thing.
So you were surprised sometimes in the things that she said, you're wondering how she found out about these things, huh? Okay. What do you feel were the what you in your own personal feeling your psychological stress that you might recollect that you went through when you were going on these long missions that you never knew whether you're going to get back or not? What was your feeling when you went out on these flights?
Well, you're always scared, you know. Wondering if you're gonna make it back and that kind of thing, because this firebombing, you felt sorry for the people down there on the ground, all the civilians. And if you turn right around, they started the war, so you justify that way, but you couldn't help but feel
right.
Feel for them,
sure.
Even though the Japanese were barbaric, treatment of prisoners of war and things like that.
They were that.
That was the main thing. That was what you were concerned about. If you got the shutdown was caught. And the other thing you always worry about was the suicide plane.
Oh yeah.
They wouldn't. I think so. Come with us, very last moment, either we build or the guy was away or whatever. Especially at the end of the war.
So the suicide planes were not only against shipping, but our naval vessels, but also the B-29s were affected by that too. Huh? Was that a major problem?
It wasn't until toward the end of the war. The last missions, and that night at Tokyo raid, the only one I went on, but that was, you'll forget that night, the sky, the place was burning, Tokyo was burning, and B-29 very away. There were 500 or more planes at Tokyo about the same time, searchlights and fires and
that's the same
aircraft. You'd see all the planes flying too.
That's a sight that's etched in your memory, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That is something else. Did you ever have any problem with the friendly fire that damaged or any of your planes or anything? Did you work with any of our allies, or were you strictly just U.S. Army, Air Corps people that you were flying?
The only one we really worked with was the Navy on the mining mission.
Uh-huh.
At least one of them, maybe both of them. We had a Navy man that went on the mission with us.
Uh-huh.
Flew with us.
But you didn't work with the British or anybody else, huh? And
we had contact with the British in India. They had an officers' club in Kharagpur, which we were, as officers, we were allowed to use.
Uh-huh.
So we, you know, at least knew some base there.
Now, when you were still in the Marianas, the Enola Gay flew and dropped the Italian bomb. Did you know any of the crew members aboard the Enola Gay by any chance?
No, they were completely isolated from everybody else. They had their own, everything was completely self-contained.
And secret.
They were all to themselves.
Yeah. One place. How did you learn about the Enola Gay and the, I mean,
we didn't know about it till it happened. Till it happened and they made an announcement, you know.
So it was business as usual until they said, hey, we just.
Dropped
an atomic bomb.
We flew all the missions after the, first and the second drop. I think we flew other missions.
You flew other missions after the bombs were dropped.
I don't remember when, exactly when that was, but.
Well, where were you, or you weren't attending, I'm sure, when you learned of the ceasefire which resulted in victory over, in Europe? You were in the Marianas, I assume, still flying your missions.
I think General LeMay came over after, we got to the Marianas. He came over later as the commanding general, and I think that was after the
VE Day.
It was VE Day.
Yeah.
I
want to say sometime in June, but I'm not sure. And
VJ
was September.
45.
Yeah. I want to say June, something like that. But and then VJ was, early September, as I recall. I think it was.
My mission out there was the 30th of August.
30th of August, but that was right.
45.
I believe that was right before VJ Day.
That's right. They signed me off on September 2nd, my birthday.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it was very early September. So you were still flying missions on the end of August.
Right.
That's interesting. Well, say August 30th, did you say?
Well, let's see. No, the 29th was our last, was my last mission of July.
Oh, July.
And then I flew a mission on the 30th of August. And got down here with the weather ship. I don't remember what that was about.
Yeah, it wasn't a bombing mission, no.
Apparently, that was a month in there, but we were doing nothing. So apparently, when they surrendered or whatever it was.
Did you, can you recollect any feelings you may have had when VE Day occurred, or was it just kind of?
Oh, and, you know, glad it was over. That just we had to fly over there. You know.
How about VJ Day then? What were your feelings then? Do you have any recollection?
Well, that's what I was thinking. I know I don't nothing about VE Day, you know.
No, VJ Day.
Fighting. Well, VJ Day was that. That's what I was talking about then. Well, just glad it was over, you know.
Yeah. Right. Just glad it was over. Yeah. I guess everybody shared that, all right. How was it determined when you would be allowed to come home? How was that? How did that work? You were there on Tinian, and
I think
the war was over.
They had a point, a point system that was determined your
priority, I guess.
Priority of getting back, and that was based on how long you've been away, how many missions you've flown, things like that.
So after the war was over, do you recollect how long you were still on Tinian before you were able to start on your way home? You're over there.
October 1945, I was ordered to Mather Field, Sacramento. So
you're there
over a month. Anyway. So it was about a month. About a month and a half before I left to come back.
Did you have any inkling, Bob, from your own calculation of the, or I don't know if you were able to calculate your points that you had, but did you have any idea of when you thought you'd be able to get out, or was it kind of a surprise when you got your orders? Or
I guess it must have been sort of a surprise when it did come through. I've got the actual point things there, but it doesn't tell you much of them.
Yeah.
How many points I had and what relation it is to all the other,
you know,
where I was on the deal. And we also came back sort of as a crew.
Oh, you did?
My co-pilot, the co-pilot who had been flying with us, actually flew the plane back and we brought back. And I don't know who else was on, you know. I know he and I were released on the, bought the plane back. Who else was in the crew? I seem like we had a general with us who flew back with us. Was being returned to the state.
Uh-huh. So you got orders back to the States, and then you reported, where was it you reported?
We flew in at Matthew Field, California.
Uh-huh. And then
Then they sent me from there to Goldsboro,
North
Carolina, to be discharged.
Okay.
Closest to Greenville, South Carolina.
So that was pretty quick then. In other words, you just went directly from Tinian to California to Goldsboro.
Right. And I don't remember spending much time in a day or two in California.
Uh-huh. So when they elected to discharge you, happened pretty fast, yeah. Sounds like, just the space of a few days. When you were discharged, did you take advantage of the GI Bill? You'd already been to college. But,
no, I went to finish school on the...
You finished school on the GI Bill?
Yeah. Good.
And some other just general questions here. Do you think the Hollywood movies and so forth have accurately portrayed what you witnessed during the war? You know, from the movies that you've seen and so forth, can you relate to them?
I think so. I think they were better representative. The one with Frank Sinatra and the name of it, man. But I think it was a faithful
depiction
of it. Right.
Do you have any particular humorous or sad incidents that you recall from your time in the service? I'm sure you lost some friends somewhere along the line, so forth. But anything that might be either funny or maybe the reverse. You can recall.
Well, the most humorous thing is recall that having the bailouts, like I say, the bailout procedure in the front of the B-29, the bombardier comes back and jumps. The radio man comes around the turret and jumps. The navigator jumps. Co-pilot jumps. Flight engineer jumps. And the pilot. Well, the second bailout, the radio man came by and got to the thing. He didn't want to jump. Of course, it was his first time. So I told him, get out of my way. Let me get out of there. he's still alive. I still kid him about that. He is in bad shape, though.
He didn't want to jump. but he finally did, obviously.
I'd already been through experience, so I knew what was happening.
End of tape A, side 2. The interview continues on tape B, side 1.
Do you think the Hollywood movies and so forth have accurately portrayed what you witnessed during the war?
you know, from the movies that you've seen and so forth, do you, can you relate to them?
I think so. I think they were better representative. There were one with Frank Sinatra and I don't know the name of it, but I think it was a faithful
depiction
of it.
Do you have any particular humorous or sad incidents that you recall from your time in the service? I'm sure you lost some friends somewhere along the line, so forth, but anything that might be funny or maybe the reverse that you can recall?
Well, the most humorous thing is that, you know, recall that having the bailouts, like I say, the bailout procedure in front of the B-29, the bombardier comes back and jumps. The radio man comes around the turret and jumps. The navigator jumps. Co-pilot jumps. Flight engineer jumps. Then the pilot. So the second bailout, the radio man came by and got to the thing. He didn't want to jump. Because it was his first time. So I told him, get out of my way, let me get out of there. he's still alive. I still kid him about that. He is in bad shape, though.
He didn't want to jump. but he finally did, obviously.
Because I'd already been through experience, so I knew what was happening.
Any particularly, you might say, sad incidents from your time in service that you recall?
No, I don't, don't remember any real sad incidents. We lost people, but they were not really close friends.
Uh-huh.
We did lose two or three of our crew in the crash while we were in China, they cried while we were there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I spent quite a bit of time with them. But, I don't recall any other.
Did you see any famous people during your time in service or have any interaction with?
Drop names.
Huh?
Want me to drop names?
Yeah, sure. Drop names you may recollect.
One of my pilots in bombardier school was Jimmy Stewart. He was one of our pilots for our training squadron.
Is that right?
George Wallace was a member of our Gunner of
George
Alabama.
George Wallace, yeah, okay.
He was a member of our not our squadron, our group. Johnny Heckinger was our television officer. Heckinger Stowers.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But he still comes to some of our reunions.
Yeah.
Amelia Earhart's husband was our intelligence officer in the States.
Who's that one?
Major Putnam.
That's very interesting. Did you ever have occasion, somebody like Jimmy Stewart, for example, what was his job on the base again?
Pilot.
He was a pilot in what, for training or?
Flying his training plane.
And of course, he ultimately went on to flew missions in Europe, as I recollect anyway. I think he did. Okay. You ever see Bob Hope or any of the entertainers come through? Any of those folks?
I don't know if I'm seeing Bob Hope, but the USO shows have come through, and I remember famous tennis players coming through and playing exhibitions. Don Budge is one of those. A famous baseball player or something, maybe he played with a base team or something. I don't remember his name.
What would you consider to have been your most important, maybe, or significant experience that you had? Anything that you point to that is particularly memorable to you about your military experience, Bob? The most memorable thing that you might recall? You had quite a few, I'd say.
Well, you know, you think about it, I always remember how young everybody was. You know, even flying the B-29. Even the pilots were, because I was probably one of the youngest. But even the pilots flying that big airplane, you know, not more than 2 or 3 years old than I. Even now, you know, the reunion, I'm still probably one of the younger people with all these reunions. And there is, let's see, the five, the B-29 had 11 men on the crew. Of the original crew, there are five of us still alive. Three of us used to make all these reunions. The other two are in bad health. They haven't seen them in several years.
How would you characterize your military service? Just kind of sum it up.
Well, it was satisfactory because I got through that, got back. And something I had to do.
Yeah.
Felt like it was my duty to do it.
You did your duty. Okay, tell me about briefly then after, just kind of seal this thing, you might say. You got out of the service, you went to GI Bill, and just briefly outline what happened to you up to the present then. You went to work for?
Well, when I got out of the Army, I went back to Georgia Tech under GI Bill, and I went straight through. I didn't take any vacation, and I finished in, I guess, 2 years. Going around the clock. And we got married. I guess in my senior year. I graduated, went to work for B.F. Goodrich in Thomaston, Georgia. I worked there till. They finished in 48, worked within 5 years, 53 I came to work with Fieldcrest. And I worked with Fieldcrest until I retired. Except in 1 year, I went back and worked with a consulting firm in Atlanta for a year, but came back to Fieldcrest.
What were your main responsibilities with Fieldcrest? Engineering?
Or? I was engineering. I was a project engineer. And, became the director of engineering in 72, I guess, 72, when I retired in 85.
And you've been living here in Eden since then, I think it's. You were retired a year before I came to Eden. I came to work at Fieldcrest in 86. Just kind of a concluding question, I guess, again, relating to your military experience. How would you say that your military experience changed you? What effect has it had on your life? Anything that you can point to that you can think of that might have left a lasting imprint on you?
Well, I would assume the discipline and all would be one of them. Being so young, I went in when I was 19, and I'm sure those 4 or 5 years of discipline had a major effect on
me. Served you well. Anything else you want to say, Bob, before we conclude this?
No, I don't think so. That's
okay. Well, that concludes the interview with Robert A. Hardin, Jr. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
A direction of the President under the provisions of the Act of Congress approved 2nd July 1926 and pursuant to the authority delegated by Headquarters United States Army Strategic Air Forces in Letter File AG-323, the Distinguished Flying Cross is awarded to Robert A. Hardin. First Lieutenant Robert A. Hardin, Jr., 0731508, 792nd Bombardment Squadron, 468th Bombardment Group, Air Corps, United States Army. For extraordinary achievement while participating in aerial flight as navigator in a B-29 aircraft and daylight attack against the Kure Naval Base, Japan, 22nd June 1945, from the Marianas Islands. Before arriving at the target, all navigational aids became inoperative, and a heavy cloud covering made celestial navigation almost an impossibility. Undaunted by these discouraging conditions, Lieutenant Hardin brought his plane to the target and home again. His professional ability and outstanding initiative were primarily responsible for the bomber continuing to the target, strengthening the formation, and causing a larger percentage of bombs to be dropped on the briefed target. The untiring energy and meticulous navigation of this veteran of repeated assaults against the Japanese homeland reflect great credit on himself and the Army Air Forces.